inequity.
And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 812 and invite Representative Gomberg forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For your record, I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. Just give me a moment to get organized. I'm supposed to testify on two bills at 3 o'clock, one dealing with vermouth sales and one with septic tanks. I don't want to give you the wrong testimony. Mr. Chairman, if you'll bear with me for a moment, since I know there's some newer members of the committee, I wanted to provide a little bit of background on where Senate Bill 812 came from. Last year, the Oregon legislature enacted the Septic System Replacement Program, which was then Senate Bill 1563, and it created the first ever program designed to help homeowners and small businesses replace their failed septic systems. As of March of 2017, the program has served families in over 19 cities and 13 counties across the state, installing systems that will treat over 3 million gallons annually of wastewater at a cost of nearly $500,000. The $200,000 initial investment made by the Oregon legislature has been matched by an additional $350,000 in private philanthropy. In short, the program has been proven to be a successful and cost-effective way to help Oregonians replace their failed septic systems and promote healthier communities and natural systems. Well, now we've got Senate Bill 812, which makes three useful changes to the program. So we're talking about a couple of technical fixes. The first two changes would clarify the program's focus, ensuring that it does not require small businesses or homeowners to replace systems that are not required by law or policy. The other proposed change would allow an owner to borrow an amount less than the full septic replacement price. Upon implementation, it was discovered that the law required borrowers to borrow the full amount required to replace a system. While in some instances the borrowers needed the full amount, we don't want to require small businesses or homeowners to borrow more than they need, and this correction would also help stretch the dollars available to make loans to other customers. So, in short, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're doing a couple of things here. As I just summarized, we're not going to make you borrow the full amount if you don't need the full amount. The other thing is, rather than forcing you to replace or repair a septic system, if it's more practical and more appropriate, you can tie into an existing sewer system rather than buying a septic system. Those are the technical fixes that this bill would make to Senate Bill 1563 from last session. I think there's some people here that can testify in a lot more detail to that. This concept came forward largely through the efforts of Senator Roblin, and I want to thank him for making a big difference out on the coast, where too often the septic systems are causing a lot of problems, not only for the owners, but also for the neighbors and to the waterways that they abut. I'll try and answer any questions you have some, or I can step out of the way and bring up brighter minds and more experienced voices than my own.
Any questions for Representative Gomberg? Representative Reske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment. I'd like to hear the vermouth presentation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Reske, actually, you already voted yes on the vermouth program. I just had to take it over and then sell it to the Senate.
There we go.
Any other questions for Representative Gomberg?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I think I'll just invite everybody up at once. John Audley, Michael Van Dyke, and Peggy Lynch. John, could I have you start, since I think you're working on this program right now?
It'll be shorter, too, because the representative shared all the good stuff. For the record, my name is John Audley. I'm here representing Craft 3, a nonprofit lender whose mission is to promote resilient communities. Founded 22 years ago, Craft 3 has now invested over $400 million in small businesses and consumer loans in Washington and in Oregon. Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my testimony reflects positions taken by nine organizations, all of whom submitted a letter to you, and I won't go into the details. Representative Gomberg's done a great job of summarizing the success of this program and why these technical fixes are important to help stretch limited dollars so we can continue to serve Oregonians whose septic systems are failing. Just a couple of additional comments in. I think it's remarkable that in a short period of time, a program that just got started has served so many counties across Oregon. 13 counties in 6 months is a reflection of a statewide program, but also of the need that the entire state, not just the western coastal counties, face when it comes to systems that, like this, that are failing. With all due respect to where we are right now, the $200,000 initial investment was matched by two foundations, one in Seattle, one in Portland. Their commitment to match the state dollars is a function of the state's ability to reflect the priority that this is, and we hope that, as challenging as budgets are this time, that we're able to replenish this to continue to create this revolving loan fund. It's a great program. I'm proud to represent Craft 3 in its capacity to administer this on behalf of the state, and I'm happy to answer any questions about its implementation that you have. Thanks.
Well, we finished testimony, then we'll have questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, members of the committee. My name is Michael Van Dyke, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors today, asking you to support Senate Bill 812. Importantly, we worked with DEQ back prior to the 2016 session on the Septic Smart program. We also supported Senate Bill 1563 in 2016 as being a very important program, and I think John appropriately highlighted how successful that program has been with 19 cities and 13 counties. We understand that these technical changes are important, and we support them being made in Senate Bill 812. And I think that I will end it there and just say to support Senate Bill 812. Thank you.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. We've been working on this issue for a very long time and highlighted it in our coastal study that we finished a while back. So the reason I came up, besides being a sign-on to the joint letter that you saw, is that Senate Bill 383 is a funding bill for this program. So right now, this is a great bill, should pass, need to correct the program, but if there's no money for it to go into, it's a great program, should pass. End of subject. So I want to make sure that we have a conversation. I know that it's really difficult, and so we need more revenue. I say that every time I come to testify on things. This is an important program. It has a public-private partnership. It's a good expenditure of dollars, and although the $1.5 million that's in 383 may be more than we can deal with this session, we certainly need to have some money in the system. I want to make one more comment, and that's that NOAA has withheld monies from DEQ and DLCD in the Coastal Zone Management Program, in part because of this issue, also because of legacy logging roads that need to be dealt with. But this program, at least, would show that we are actually moving to address the issues around water quality in the coastal zone. So, for all of those reasons, I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Questions for this panel?
Representative John. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. It's a great bill. John, could you talk a little bit about Craft 3 and the loan programs and how they're administered?
Sure.
For the folks that participate in this, and how do these loans, if somebody has an existing mortgage, would this be subordinate to that in the first position, or where would that be?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, great question. For those of you unfamiliar with Craft 3, it is a nonprofit lender certified by the Department of Treasury back in D.C. So it doesn't function like a bank. It doesn't hold your reserves, your savings accounts, if you will. Its funds tend to come from three sources primarily. National banks are oftentimes obligated by the United States government to invest in underserved communities. So those banks loan Craft 3 funds. That's about 40-45% of its operating capital. Another important source of funds increasingly is partnerships with state and federal governments. So it administers, for example, to borrow from our neighbors to the north, it administers a substantial part of the state's clean energy funds, about $18 million, where it then takes those funds and triples at this stage of the game the funds that the state is willing to invest in manufacturing interested in energy efficiency improvements. And then the rest of the last large source are private philanthropy, Meyer Memorial Trust, and in this instance, the Laird Norton Foundation up in Seattle is the second foundation that was interested in willing to support this. All of Oregon's major foundations invest or support Craft 3's work. The way it administers the loans and the program is, first of all, consistent with the guidance that you all gave it through the legislation, 1563. So it reports quarterly, or is it monthly? It's frequently to DEQ. The numbers that we shared with you are the product of the March report. The way the program itself works is that, and I'll use you as a hypothetical, so you have a failed septic system. You've probably been notified by the county or DEQ that your system has failed and you must fix it. You tend to go to a contractor who is in the business of doing this. So you ask her for help in figuring out what the system is that you need. Then the contractor, because we do a lot of marketing, may refer you to or recommend that you contact Craft 3 as a possible source of funds to borrow to install your system. So the loan is made with you directly, the customer, but we pay the contractor directly for services rendered. We want to make sure that the contractor gets all of her funds. And we felt that that was a good way to do it. We take subordinate positions on the loans, and in many instances, because again, it's not a bank, it's a nonprofit lender. The more challenging your financial circumstances, the more favorable your terms. To illustrate, presently based on available funds, if your family income I think is less than $40,000, you get a no principal, no interest 15-year loan that doesn't require payment until the term of the contract is up. So it's designed to keep you in place, to make your life healthier, to stop the problem, which is why we thought it was such a great program in the first place.
Great. Thank you very much.
Representative Brock-Smith and then Representative Rusky.
Not a question, just a comment on Craft 3. Fantastic organization. They've been very helpful. They were a major partner in the BC Fisheries project down in the Port of Brookings Harbor, which has provided over 30 full-time family jobs in South County where they're desperately needed. I was familiar with this on-site septic program in my former life as a county commissioner, and a lot of the folks down there need these programs, especially with their low-income circumstances and the high costs of the septic replacement. A lot of the septic, as the chair probably knows, has to deal with sand filters and more expensive systems because of the soil types that we deal with. And so thank you, and please extend my thanks to Craft 3 and all their good work.
Thanks for the plug. Thanks.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the average loan amount, or is there a range you can give me of what the replacement costs are?
Sure. Chair Helm, members of the committee, and I'm not the lender. I mean, I'm a contractor government relations person for them, but I've been around it enough to at least give you
a range.
In Oregon, they tend to range in and around $20,000 to $24,000.
Okay.
They tend to establish a loan amount in excess of the anticipated total project cost to kind of approve you for a higher amount. And every loan includes an operation and maintenance contract for the life of the loan, because they want to make sure that not only did you install a new system, but you take care of the new system. The last thing you want to do is see it break because of lack of service, but they've been running around $20,000 to $22,000 once they're done.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Rep. Reschke, you stole my question, so I already got it.
Any further questions for the panel? Representative Holby.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate this bill. It's something that needs to happen. We need to upgrade our septic systems, no doubt about it. Do you know how many of these systems that get loans are for systems that have failed because they're old, as opposed to systems that need to be replaced because they didn't have proper siting to start with? And I say that because, you know, it's a little frustrating sometimes to note that a county, for example, will issue septic tank systems all around a lake and, expect no problems to develop from that. And then to some years later find out that the systems that were approved really aren't adequate to protect those waterways. Same thing happens around rivers with people plopping a lot of septic systems along rivers. And so it's a little frustrating to see that, you know, the state puts in money to solve these problems that, you know, to me should have, you know, maybe be caught at the front end saying, maybe we've got too many septic systems in this soil type. For example, a science that's been around for a long, long time, but doesn't seem to have really filtered out into the decision-making process. Loaded question.
Yeah, totally loaded. Chair, Representative Holby, members of the committee, we are not in the business of asking why it failed. We're in the business of helping someone whose system has failed. What I can tell you is that, and again, this is based on the way the legislation was written, much credit to Senators Olson on the other side of the Capitol. The customer works closely with the regulatory agency, be it DEQ or the county, and the system installed is a function of the guidance that whichever appropriate regulator insists that that the system adhere to. Recently, I had an installer actually from Coos Bay over from I think it was in Representative Brock Smith's neighborhood, so Coos Bay South. And he described the manner in which, and this is for his customers, DEQ, they work very closely to make sure that it's the right system given circumstances. That has a tendency to reflect on cost, but the goal is to get the right system in. Don't charge any more than the system needs to be, and then take care of it for as long as you can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, just so in our 2012 report in Oregon, over 30% of residents and businesses have septic systems in Oregon. And the EPA estimated at that time that 10 to 20% of all septic systems fail each year. We know that that's been true in the McKinsey. When EWEB got some money and allowed or had 400 and some septic systems along the McKinsey tested, and I have forgotten what the percentage was that were failed or at least needed to be pumped. But it was severe. In Lapine, we know that the situation for their groundwater in the Deschutes is also a real crisis, and trying to figure out how to deal with that. They did create a new city of Lapine, and in part that was because of this septic failure, but they didn't agree with or include all of the people that really had septic systems in the Lapine area. So we just know that this is a real serious problem, and whether it's failing septic systems or because there were too many located in one location is hard to know. But the truth is we have failing septics in Oregon, and they are costly. You just heard. They usually run somewhere around $15,000 at least, and we just need to address this issue for clean water in Oregon.
If I may, the numbers that we estimate with DEQ's assistance is that we estimate that over a biennium that there's $3 million worth of business to do out there. there is no guarantee that Kraft III would be the administrator of the program going forward. We'll compete, assuming DEQ reissues the RFP. But we're confident that should we be in a position to administer the program again over a biennium, that our goal would be to raise $3 million so that we'd have enough, both to provide access to the loans for customers, but also to substantially contribute to what is effectively a revolving loan fund. You pay your bill back, I loan it out again. That's what's happening in Washington. There are 700 customers served in around only the Puget Sound area, $16 million. It is a revolving loan fund. They're loaning $1 million a quarter. It's happened in Washington. We can do it here as well.
Just a follow-up comment. It's not that I don't support this program or support, replacing failing systems. It's a frustration. I had a constituent issue around this where a constituent has family owned the property for over 100 years, and they were the only ones around, but the county kept issuing more septic tank systems along that river, and pretty soon their system wasn't adequate because there was so much, sewage trying to be filtered by the soils, and that was no longer effective anymore, and so now, they have to upgrade to a much more expensive system through no fault of their own. And, some responsibility has to go, to municipalities that are issuing these septic systems permits and thinking long range about what the soil type can really handle. So that's my only comment. Thank you.
Representative Brocksmith.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Further, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. So is $3 million what we need to make this a self-sustaining? How much capital has to be invested in this before we really have a self-sustaining program? I mean, the need is so ginormous. The systems are expensive. How do we ever get a handle on the magnitude of the problem?
Chair Helm, Representative Marsh, members of the committee, that's a very hard question to answer. What I can say is that in Washington, this program has been in place for 10 years. It started at a county level, and quite literally from county to county along the Puget Sound, in the Puget Sound area, those counties banded together to pool capital, while Kraft III then raised additional capital to create what eventually became the revolving loan fund. That's focused only on counties in western Washington. The goal now is to actually head over to Washington's dry side and provide similar services, which are also in need in central Washington. It just takes time. Our hope is that through continued support for a short period of time and the continued philanthropy of foundations who see the opportunity to be of both public service and natural systems health, that we can get there fairly quickly. We are estimating demand. It's based on EPA data and DEQ's knowledge. And then we estimate conservatively those folks who will actually seek out low-interest loans as opposed to just take care of it on their own. This is 6 months, data. So we'll have to see.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 812. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 19, Senate Bill 19A, and invite up Jason Barber and Steve Harrington. Welcome. Go right ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. Chair Helm, committee members, my name is Jason Barber. I'm a program area director for the Department of Ag. With me today is my colleague, Dr. Stephen Harrington. He's the program manager for Weights and Measures, Motor Fuel Quality, and our metrology lab. Senate Bill 19 was basically our statutory cleanup bill, and it was going to do really four things for us. We were going to simplify and update a some abbreviations on a list of substances banned from blending with gasoline. We were also going to distinguish between ethanol and denatured fuel ethanol, and basically denatured means that you poison ethanol so it can't be used for human consumption. We were going to update a couple of references regarding ethanol again to more current ASTM standards, and we were going to tweak the statute and make it easier for us to work with our stakeholders to adjust dispenser labeling. As we were at the Senate hearing, and the reason this has an amendment, is a couple gentlemen representing the Small Marine Engine Association came forward and objected to the bill mainly around wanting to remove butanol from the list of banned substances. We went back, vetted that with our stakeholders, mainly the Oregon Fuels Association and WSPA, Western States Petroleum Association. They didn't have any objection to that. Dr. Harrington has a nice email listserv that he's able to reach out to the rest of the country, motor fuel quality programs. He sent that out. We got, interestingly enough, Oregon and Arizona were the only two states that banned butanol. And ironically, Arizona has a bill going right now to take it off their list as well. So we wrote back and told the Senate it was fine to take that off the list. So that was the amendment. And other than that, we're happy to answer any questions.
Why don't you go right ahead with your testimony if you have it, and then we'll get folks to.
Oh, actually, I'm Chair Helm, members of the committee. Jason Barber had the principal testimony on this. I'm just here to fill in for questions that the committee may have.
Why don't I have
technical
you
expert.
Okay, why don't I have you introduce yourself for the record then, just in case.
Dr. Stephen Harrington.
Very good. Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 19A. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 328. And invite up Amanda Dalton and Ms. Sanger. Mr. Sanger, sorry.
All right.
You'll have to help me with the spelling of your first name.
It's Irion, I-R-I-O-N.
Great. Thanks. All right. Go right ahead when you're ready.
Yes. My name is Irion Sanger, for the record. Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. I'm here today representing Biomass One, which urges you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 328. My role today is to give you a background on renewable energy certificates and why they're important. So renewable energy certificates are RECs. They're broadly understood as a market instrument or market tool which represents the property value, the property interests for the environmental, the social, and other non-power attributes of renewable energy generation. RECs, or renewable energy certificates, are also known as green tags or tradable renewable energy credits, renewable energy credits, a whole host of names. Essentially, they're the same thing. A REC is equal to 1 megawatt hour of renewable energy generation. So a megawatt is a unit of power that can power about 1,000 homes. A megawatt hour is that unit of power over 1 hour period. So a REC is equal to 1 megawatt hour. The REC itself is essentially verification or proof that that electricity was actually produced by a renewable energy source, like wind, biomass, geothermal, solar. And in Oregon, as you know, we have a renewable portfolio standard. So the renewable portfolio standard requires the Oregon electric utilities to acquire a certain amount of their power from renewable energy sources like biomass and wind. You know, in Oregon, you need to verify or register that REC, that renewable energy certificate, with an independent third-party registration service. In Oregon, that's called REGIS, or the Western Renewable Energy Generation Information System. If you do not register your REC with REGIS, or you cannot register your REC with REGIS, then your power, your electricity, does not count as renewable. So your power can be from wind or solar, but if it's not registered in Regis, then it's considered brown power, the same as coal or the same as natural gas. So in summary, a REC, a renewable energy certificate, represents the green power attributes of renewable energy, and you need to have that REC registered with Regis for it to count for Oregon's renewable portfolio standard. Thank you.
And Chair Helm and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton, also here on behalf of Biomass One. And we'll save all the hard questions for Irian at the end as well. Just so you know, Biomass One is a 30-megawatt facility down in southern Oregon. They're actually located in White City. I'll do kind of more the simple approach to the bill in front of you. I caution myself to say this is a simple fix bill in front of this committee, but it truly is a simple fix bill, while it sounds very complicated. So as Irian had said, Oregon requires, and kind of all the states participating in the renewable energy certificate market require their RECs to be registered with Regis. In Senate Bill 1547, the Coal to Clean bill passed in February of last year, there was a provision allowed for pre-95 biomass facilities to start trading these RECs immediately. Prior to that change, they had to wait until 2025. And so we have this kind of immediate trading market that starts. And so while most facilities had been registered with Regis, what we found were there was a handful that weren't. And the Department of Energy was interpreting a 2010 law on the books as requiring these facilities to have been registered prior to January 1 of 2011. And so what you were found with was a handful of facilities that either didn't register prior to January 1, 2011 because they didn't know they needed to, because the statute from 2010 never got codified into state law. They didn't want to pay the annual fee because they didn't think they could start trading until 2025, or they just did and kind of came off and didn't. I can tell you our client was maybe less than a week late to the notification period. So the bill before you really proposes a simple fix and changes that on or before January 1, 2011 to register by January 1, 2011. We are aware of only two facilities that this would apply to. I think it's important to note that it doesn't bring any new pre-95 biomass facilities into the renewable world. It simply allows those facilities to generate both renewable electricity and also participate in the renewable energy certificate trading market.
That's it. Questions for our panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. So what's the value of a REC? We know what it is, but how is the value determined?
Well, the value has changed over time from between about $1 to around $50. So the value plummeted quite precipitously a number of years ago. California made some changes which required renewable energy to essentially be generated in California to count as its RPS. Before that time, RECs were trading $30, $40, almost $50. Since California limited the market, RECs right now are trading, you know, less than $5, a couple dollars. So they're not very valuable at this particular moment in time. As the RPS in Oregon ramps up, RECs are expected to become much more valuable.
Representative Holby.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious why, if you can tell me why the original cutoff date was put in place.
2025-2026 date?
No, the 2011 date for registering facilities.
In 2010. The 2010 law.
Right. I'm not entirely certain, Representative Holdy, and there's different interpretations of that. One interpretation was that Regis was supposed to be set up by a specific date. DOE has taken a different interpretation that you needed to have registered by a particular date. So I'm not exactly certain. We searched the legislative history and did not find any indication of why that date was picked or exactly what that date meant. So I was not here at that time, but went through the entire legislative history, and we didn't find anything that explained that date.
Further questions?
Okay, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 328. And with that, committee, there's no further work for us to do today. We will be meeting on Wednesday with a handful of items, that, including work sessions on these bills. With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Energy and Environment. House Committee on Energy and Environment.